Hi, and welcome to the Let's Make It Rain podcast. I'm your host, Davinia Tomlinson. This podcast is for the rainmakers, those women who are breaking down walls, building their own empires, defying convention and rejecting stereotypes. Women who are unafraid to have open, honest conversations about money among friends and to share the truths we've been told to keep secret. Don't forget to subscribe, share, and download wherever you usually get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, then please leave us a 5-star review. Hi there, and welcome to the very first episode of the Let's Make It Rain podcast. Rainmakers, if you have been following the newsletter, The Rainmaker, you will know that this has been a really long time coming and a real labour of love getting to this point. So in this very first episode, what I'd like to do is to share with you a little bit about me, who I am, my background, my journey to entrepreneurship, and why this podcast exists, why it's so important from my perspective that we should have this conversation. So who am I? So as I said, I'm Davinia. Not only am I the host of this podcast, but I'm also the founder of a business called Raincheck. You may be familiar with it. Raincheck is a business I set up 3 years ago, specifically to help women take control of their financial futures. Now, that can mean a variety of different things. But from my perspective, you know, over the last, you know, this journey over the last 3 years has really helped me to crystallize and be quite specific about what exactly it is that we're doing and what we're trying to help women achieve. So from my perspective, Raincheck really exists to help women build sustainable long-term wealth and live life entirely on their own terms. And we're going to break that down over the course of this podcast series. And I'm going to tell you a bit more about that in this episode. So when we talk about wealth, you know, it's one of those words that I think, you know, for lots of us, it's quite a polarizing topic, isn't it? The idea of wealth. You know, if you hear even just the idea of a wealthy woman, you know, what kinds of things does it conjure in your mind? Like if you were to pause right now and think, what does a wealthy woman look like? I don't know, like, is it dynasty style, you know, Alexis? I mean, this is for the 80s babies. I'm really showing my age here. But, you know, if you are somebody that grew up on a diet of Dynasty and Dallas, is it those, you know, supremely wealthy, financially wealthy people with furs and diamonds that kind of glide around catfighting all the time? Is it spiritual wealth and wellness? Is it, you know, wealth that manifests itself in the form of really good health? You know, there are so many different ways that, you know, when we think of wealth, that it can, you know, that we can embody what that means and what that looks like. And from my perspective, it's important that as women, we're able to define for ourselves what it means to have a wealthy life, what it is that we are striving to achieve, and making sure that we've got really solid financial foundations to help us achieve that. One of the things that, you know, is particularly important to me is that we make sure that we're living life based on the things that we set out to achieve, the things that are really important to us, and not the things that society should dictate that we really should be prioritizing and focusing on. And so if you know me personally outside of Raincheck, you'll know that I'm somebody that is really free-spirited, but also supremely willful, which can be, you know, a bit of an explosive combination at times. I'm somebody that, you know, has always been quite clear in my own mind about the life that I want to lead, the things that I want to do, the lifestyle that I would like to have. And, you know, I treat it as a real privilege that I have that sense of clarity, because one of the things that I have discovered, you know, through this work and through, you know, my career to date is that as much as we can have this conversation and talk about, you know, acquiring wealth and building these solid financial foundations, for lots of us, it's a thing that we know we need to do in the spirit of adulting. But when we, you know, boil it down to what is it that we actually want to build this wealth for, you know, what are the specific life goals that we are striving towards, that it's really important that we, build a good pot in order to achieve. So outside of the obvious things like, you know, I must save into my pension so that I don't retire in destitution, there are so many years before we get to the point of retirement for many of us. And even for those of us when we reach retirement, how clear are we in our own minds about what that retirement looks like? How clear are we on the path to, you know, achieving that sense of comfort in retirement? And what does comfort mean for us? You know, it's our opportunity to be really introspective and to look more deeply within ourselves as to what are the desires of my heart? What are the things that I am happy to say outwardly? What are the things that I, you know, feel afraid to share for fear of judgment, for fear of reprisals? There is a lot of shame and a lot of guilt that's attached to lots of the things that it is that we strive towards as women. And, you know, of course, this podcast is really, you know, I expect the vast majority of the audience to be women, but I know that this applies to men as well. And for me, I think, you know, I'm at this point in my life, particularly having turned 40 this summer, which I'm really excited about. If you know me, you'll know that I'm a real hype queen about birthdays anyway, but particularly those milestone birthdays, because I always think it's an opportunity to kind of pause, reflect, and assess where I am, what I've achieved and accomplished to, up until that point, and what I would like to do in my next phase. And there is something about, you know, achieving these big milestones. It's like when I turned 30, you know, it's kind of feeling, okay, what's about to happen next? What's the next big thing for Dav? And now that I've turned 40, it's, you know, instead of me, you know, obsessing over, you know, discrete projects, accomplishments, career goals, it's stepping into this realm of what does Dav the person look like? How has she evolved over the last decade? And how will she evolve over the next decade? You know, if you can imagine that I was really hypey about turning 40, God only knows how I'm going to behave when it's time to turn 50. And for me, you know, that sense of achievement and accomplishment will come less from the things that I have acquired from a material perspective, and more from that sense of happiness and joy that is more intrinsic. You know, how satisfied am I with my life and the things that I, the experiences that I'm able to have, and just that deep sense of fulfillment that can only come from being clear about what it is that I want to achieve and making sure that I make those steps and make those moves to achieving that. So, you know, I think, you know, I talk all the time to the Rainmakers. They know me so intimately, I think, as a result of the conversations we have. And I think one of the, you know, my hallmarks is real openness about who I am with people that I feel close to and that I can trust. And one of the things that I hope we can cultivate over the course of this podcast series is this sense of candor around the conversations that we're having. I think, you know, as women, whether it's money that we're talking about or any other aspect of our lives, when you're in an environment in which you're able to be free and authentic, you can be your best self. You can support one another in a way that's far more powerful than if you feel that, you know, oh, I don't want to say this because I wonder whether they're judging me. All of us will have completely distinctive and unique paths. And so what we need to be able to do is to stand really firmly in that path and in our truths so that we're able to inspire other people that are watching us, inspire our daughters. I have two daughters, as many of you will know. And it's important to me that they are watching me live my life in such a way that does no harm to other people, but most importantly, does no harm to me, does no harm to me from a spiritual perspective, from a self-development perspective, that when we talk about self-care and self-love, that we are really, as Rainmakers, living and breathing it every day so that we can inspire the next generation. So, as I've said, you know, I'm a mother of two. I have two young daughters. My background is in the investment management world, so I started my career, oh my gosh, well, I've already said that I'm 40, so you know it's almost two decades ago. I started on a graduate program at one of the world's largest asset management companies. And that was really where the germ of the idea for Raincheck was first planted. But if you go back even further than, you know, me starting that role, my inspiration and my impetus for wanting to join the very heady and fast-paced world of finance came from me being exposed to a very iconic movie that I perhaps shouldn't have been watching, but it was the 80s, Working Girl. Does anybody remember Working Girl? That movie with Sigourney Weaver and Melanie Griffith. And I remember watching that movie and being utterly enthralled by those two leading characters, these powerful women. I mean, the men were very much kind of in a supporting role. It was about having these two very powerful, trailblazing, ambitious women that were absolutely smashing it in a very male-dominated role and industry. And I remember watching that movie and being like, I want to be like those women. I want to be able to walk into a room and command that level of attention. I want to be somebody that's operating at the top of my game. And the world of finance looks absolutely ideal for me. That's what I'm going to pursue. And of course, fast forward, you know, from that point when I must have been, I don't know, 9 or 10, fast forward, you know, another decade. And that was the industry that I found myself within. Now, the one thing that I would say, because I know that finance and the investment world and what have you has really bad press. The one thing that I would say is that from my perspective, at least, it met all of my expectations. It had the pace that I wanted. It had, you know, it absolutely had that level of aggression. It was very testosterone fueled. But one of the things that I loved most about being in that environment was that I was able to be my full and authentic self. I never felt like I had to shrink or censor myself in any way. I could speak my mind, which is something that, if you know me, is really important to me, that in any space that I'm in, that I'm able to respectfully assert myself and state my opinions. Now, I know that that experience is not necessarily one that is shared by the vast majority, actually, of other women that have had roles in the finance industry. And certainly later in my career and later in my life when I became a mother, the extent to which I was able to progress, to the extent that I'd been able to progress prior to becoming a mother, suddenly became more challenging. And I think that there are lots of mothers that can attest to that. You know, we're going to talk about the motherhood penalty and what happens when you become a mother, and the implications of that for our careers a bit later. But certainly from my perspective, I remember feeling like, yes, this is absolutely the right industry for me. It's not perfect, but I'm not perfect within it. But what I want to do is to learn as much as I possibly can. I was exposed again to some really, really inspiring women that were doing great things within, certainly within the company that I worked for. And they just kind of continued that tradition from my perspective of me starting with Working Girl and me now entering into this company and seeing women operating in very senior and influential positions. So that was all great news. The downside, of course, is that if you imagine for me, a black Brummie with Caribbean heritage, who was excited to be able to move down to the big city. You know, I was delighted to live in London, and London is still by far one of my favourite cities in the world for its vibrancy and its diversity and everything else. But I remember thinking to myself, we live in such a diverse city, but yet when you look across when you look in the boardroom, at least, when you look across the office floor, I was very much the only. And by that, I mean, you know, I started on a graduate scheme. There were probably 10 of us in that year that joined. I was the only black person. I was one of three women. And of course, you start to notice these things, you know, over the course of your career. I started to notice that actually, you know, the more senior you become, the more male it became and the whiter it became. Now, this is not, you know, the purpose of this podcast is not to cast aspersions on, you know, diversity, inclusion within the financial services industry. I think, you know, the fact that I was able to have a successful career from my perspective within the industry demonstrates that actually there is in one way opportunities for people to grow and to thrive, but those opportunities are so limited. And I think that was really, you know, the beginning of my awakening around what does inclusion look like from a very real perspective. So this is not kind of performative allyship that, you know, we see quite often companies doing. They'll have, you know, they might have whole D&I departments. They might sponsor certain events from a corporate perspective. But then when you look at the, you know, who's got a seat at the table, who has a voice, who can, you know, who are the people that comprise the board, you'll see that actually it's still very homogenous. And, you know, I remember thinking at that early stage, this is really interesting because I know so many talented people that are just like me that wouldn't have a chance of having the opportunity that I have had. So that, I think, was kind of moment of truth number one. Moment of truth number two, I think, for me was thinking, okay, you know, when we look at all of this data, and, you know, on a graduate scheme, you're exposed to huge amounts of data and you end up doing quite a lot of, you know, analytics. And I remember digging into this data around our client base and doing some segmentation work and reflecting on the fact that, you know, despite this company, this industry managing trillions of dollars in assets on behalf of investors worldwide, the proportion that was managed on behalf of female investors was negligible. That was my second moment of truth. And if you fast forward, you know, with lots of different things, you know, the highs and lows of my career past that point, that is really what led me to building a business in the industry that I loved. So I knew that if I was going to work for myself, it had to be within the world of finance because that's where my passion, my interest and my background lies. But more importantly, I wanted to do something that would fill a gap that existed. And from my perspective, the big gap that existed was around financial inclusion. How could we democratize access to people that didn't have bold bracket salaries, that were not commanding these massive bonuses, were still really well-educated professionals, but were just not being catered to, were basically being ignored. That there wasn't, they felt that it was a conversation that excluded them. And so on that basis, they found themselves having to be quite resourceful about how they manage their money themselves. And there are people that have achieved amazing things without necessarily having the access to the expertise that others might have. But from my perspective, I was like, why should anybody feel that the door is shut in their face? Why should anybody go into a financial advisor's office and feel like, or be told directly, you actually don't have enough in the way of liquid assets or investable assets for me to take you on board as a client, that you potentially would be unprofitable for me to onboard as a client. And so on that basis, I can't help you. I can't imagine how demoralizing those kinds of conversations must feel. And they were conversations that I have heard anecdotally from others that they've experienced. They are conversations that I have observed myself. And so for me, that was very much something that I wanted to do something about. Of course, the second point is thinking financial inclusion in general has to include everyone. It can't be something that's viewed as for men and that women, like, you know, we might have done traditionally, you know, women are going to take the support role and therefore not, you know, if we're not going out into the workplace and don't have that same financial agency, on that basis, we should just be seen and not heard. To me, I was like, you know, having grown up in a very matriarchal environment, a very matriarchal background and family with, you know, a whole cast of trailblazing women that are just smashing it in all different walks of life. You know, I come from a family that, you know, with a really inspiring mother, a really powerful, well, two really powerful grandmothers, who, I come from a very immigrant background. And so one of the things that was drilled into us from a very early age was, you know, the importance and the power of education in improving our outcomes and our life choices and chances, really. So coming from that background in which, you know, there are so many women that are cheering me on, that are supporting me. You know, one of my grands was, you know, one of my earliest investors into Ranger. Can I always say she was my very first angel investor? She's an angel in more ways than one. And so from my perspective, you know, coming from this background, having this experience and then stepping into a world in which women are excluded from the conversation. You know, my gran was the first person I knew in life to have a financial advisor. And I think the significance of that can't be understated. You know, when you consider that she was somebody that moved to the UK from the Caribbean at the age of 20, she already had, or 21, she already had two children at that point. She went on to have three more. So this is somebody that had five children together with my granddad, worked in a factory, built a nest egg for herself, was very careful with her money, found a way to enjoy life. And we're going to talk about some of the ways that my gran was an inspiration to me in terms of my free-spiritedness and, you know, my sense of well-being and how to, you know, make sure that I am in charge of my own well-being and that I don't devolve responsibility for it to a third party. She was somebody that was very clear and is someone that is very clear about the things that she needs to do to feel good. And she just does them. She doesn't censor or inhibit herself in any way. But coming from that background in which, you know, she built enough in the way of assets to warrant having a financial advisor. And Peter, who became part of our family, you know, I always refer to it as the Peter and Rita show. My gran is Rita. Peter was the financial advisor. And he would come periodically for those meetings. He would sit down at the family table and have a full Caribbean meal with us. Such is the way that our culture is. And, you know, again, it was that effectively was another moment of truth for me, you know, being so comfortable with the idea that if you need expertise around how to do anything in life, whether it's managing your money, whether it's your well-being and wellness, you pay for the expertise of professionals. And so from one of the things that I was able to observe working in the industry, working in the finance industry, was that getting access to professionals was limited, as I say, to those people that were operating in the upper tiers from an earnings perspective, from a wealth perspective. And definitely it was something that was seen to be cordoned off from women. So to me, particularly with my background, I was like, this is not good enough. This is completely unacceptable. I know so many talented, amazing, well-educated, high-earning women, and they should feel like they are able to have conversations with people that can help them to maximize their wealth in order to achieve all of the different things that they want to achieve in life. You know, Ernst & Young did a study a few years ago in which they pointed to the fact that women are more predisposed to human financial advice. You know, we live in a world in which there's this kind of the advent of digital and fintech or financial technology. And, you know, we have an ability to manage our finances and manage our lives really in lots of different ways through apps. And it's brilliant. It's one of the best things or one of the most exciting new developments for humanity, I think, in kind of opening up access to the world and giving people access to experiences and to expertise that they maybe previously hadn't had. But when we think about robo-advice, and, you know, I'm a big fan of robo-advice for the reasons that I've given around financial inclusion, but Ernst & Young in that study highlighted that when it came to women, we are more predisposed to wanting to speak to another person rather than managing our finances exclusively through some of these robo-advisors where you don't necessarily speak to someone and you kind of put your information through a decision tree and the algorithm will spit out a recommendation for you. I maintain that there is still a place for technology that can enable you to do that. Particularly, you know, we live such busy lives. You want to be able to manage, and, you know, particularly those of us that are, you know, we DIY so many other things in our lives. You want to feel like I have a good grasp on my finances and I haven't outsourced it to somebody else. But when you think about the power of financial advice, one of the things that I always stress is that it's the same as any kind of personal relationship. Ultimately, what you are trying to achieve is that level of chemistry. You want to have a relationship that will last a lifetime. And for some of the financial advisors that I most admire, and I'm going to introduce some of them to you over the course of this podcast series, they have built really deep relationships with their clients over the long term. They have been with their clients through marriages, through divorce in some cases, through bereavement, through childbirth, through second marriages. There are so many life experiences and milestones that they have been there to advise, to guide, to coach, to cheerlead every step of the way. And in those really rich and intense experiences, the best outcomes are achieved. And from my perspective, I was like, all of the women that I know, they need to be able to get access to these experiences. There's no reason why they should be excluded from the conversation. So if you boil that all down, what the conclusion that I came to was that Raincheck was going to be a business that at least sought to solve these challenges. So what we were going to try to do is to plug this financial advice gap, which saw that men were being disproportionately taken on as clients and that there was exclusion for certain people if they didn't have or they weren't currently earning a significant or at least in the eyes of the industry, a significant amount of money. And also we were going to open up the conversation around finance. So in addition to giving people access to, or women specifically, access to really good quality financial advice, we were also going to make sure that these women felt good and confident and powerful in their ability to self-advocate when it came to their finances. And this, you know, we started from the perspective 3 years ago, you know, Raincheck very much started from the perspective of why aren't more women investing? You know, from my perspective as somebody that had worked in the industry, I could see, you know, the power of finance in helping people transform their lives and transform their fortunes. And I was like, why aren't more women investing? And part of the reason, you know, that I observed and the conclusion that I came to was that it's because it's either not being presented in a way that's engaging. And by that, I don't mean it has to be dumbed down to some ridiculous level, because that really irritates me. But instead, it had to be communicated in such a way that it would captivate women's imaginations, that women could feel like, okay, this is not just finance for its own sake, but that it's aligned very closely with the life goals that I have for myself, whatever they look like. For some women, it might be starting a family. For others, it's not starting a family at all. It might be, I want to travel the world. For some women, it might be, I want to be able to leave my career and change careers. And that might involve taking a pay cut. And so how will I plug that gap? You know, there are a number of different things and desires that women want to achieve. And, you know, I started from a place of saying, I want women to understand how to invest. I want them to reduce their dependency on cash saving, because we recognize that, you know, for lots of women, there is absolutely no issue with our diligence and our conscientiousness when it comes to saving money for later life or saving for the things that we want to do. But it's where we're putting that money. And we'll talk about that in a moment. So that's really where the idea for Raincheck came from. But then, you know, when I think about, you know, outside of my journey to entrepreneurship, when I was first setting up Raincheck, of course, you know, being somebody that is very type A and very busy, you know, very extroverted, I really wanted to have lots of conversations with people about, you know, to kind of test the idea, get their feedback. You know, is this something that you think has some mileage in it? Do you think that there is a market and a demand for it? And it's very interesting to me that, you know, although the feedback was overwhelmingly positive, it's interesting that we always remember the most negative things, isn't it? I mean, I'm sure there are some of you that are listening that will probably be nodding your head and smiling at that. If somebody, you know, if 20 people tell you that you look beautiful, but one person says, are you sure that dress isn't a bit tight? You're going to remember that that person who said the dress is tight. It's just human nature, and it's an awful thing. We have to remember the 20, and it's a thing that I had to train myself to do, particularly as somebody that, you know, is very exposed as an entrepreneur and being the face of the brand. But it's very interesting. One of the pieces of feedback I received from someone who was a man was that the market for female-focused finance was too small. And I don't even want to get into the, you know, how nonsensical that assertion is when you consider that we make up half of the population. But it was interesting to me that that feedback wasn't just from that man. I had feedback from women too that said, well, Dav, I don't really want to be segregated. I don't want to be treated as a special case. You know, if you build a business that's focused just on women and money, it makes it appear as though our needs are different from men's. And that feedback, you know, really resonated with me, because I had to dig really deep and reflect on what actually is the problem we are trying to resolve with Raincheck. It's not just about saying, okay, men and women are different and should be treated differently. I'm not somebody that really subscribes to this notion of men are from Mars and women are from Venus, although I know that that is a popular train of thought. I'm somebody that recognizes we live in this world alongside men. We love men. We are in relationships with men, some of us are not. And on that basis, you know, we work with men. On that basis, this conversation is one that, of course, we don't want to segregate. Of course, we don't want to, you know, we're not trying to create some kind of Raincheck inspired commune in which men are not allowed to have a voice or have an opinion. But the thing that I really thought that was important, and it's a thing that we say on the website where we talk about promoting inclusion through exclusivity, ultimately, what we're trying to do is to recognize that actually for a long time as women, we've been excluded from the conversation. And that's just fact. I mean, Starling Bank did a study a couple of years ago called Make Money Equal. And I always refer to this campaign because I love it so much. And it basically talked about the language that's used, even on a very superficial level, the language that's used in the media to address both men and women when it comes to money. And of course, as you would expect, everything, all of the publications that were targeting men talked about, you know, how they could grow their money, build their wealth by investing in real estate, in the stock market, even cryptocurrencies, and how they could build their portfolio. And in contrast, the media publications that were targeting women tended to focus much more on saving, you know, saving on your grocery bills, saving when you go into your favorite shops, how you can get a discount on your cosmetics, things of this nature. And of course, that's changing. But to think that in 2018, I think it was when that campaign was first launched, that that was a conversation and those disparities were able to be highlighted in the first place is a real shame. I think it should be a source of national shame. And so as much as I recognize that we don't want to segregate women, it really was important that we were able to have conversations collectively as women to highlight the things that perhaps we did feel uncertain about, where we did feel less confident than other areas of our lives, and to do so in a space with other women who perhaps might be feeling the same way. This is, of course, not to negate those women that are absolute financial powerhouses that are smashing it in all different aspects of their lives, including their money management. That's brilliant. Of course, we're not generalizing, but I recognized, and certainly it's been proven over the last 3 years through the amazing women that I feel privileged to have met over the course of building this business, that definitely it's a conversation that is valid. And there are women that were still crying out for this support that they just weren't getting. So that is what Raincheck is designed to help address. But then why are we talking about money anyway? And I think this is, again, you know, something that we'll be exploring over this podcast series. Why are we talking about money? Does money buy happiness? Shouldn't we be focusing on some of the other areas of our lives? And we've seen this massive explosion in the wellness industry over the last, you know, decade, I would say. And, you know, the thing that I was always very keen to stress when I first started Raincheck was that I didn't want finance to be viewed as something that was completely detached from the other aspects of our wellness. I always stress that financial well-being is as much a part of our overall well-being as our physical wellness, our mental wellness, our emotional wellness, and that we should treat it as such. I mean, if all of us, I'm sure, have experience of when money might have been tight, perhaps we've grown up in environments in which money was tight, perhaps as adults we might have struggled with debt, for example. We might have had situations where we just feel completely unsure, even if we're earning a good amount of money, where we just worry about, you know, our ability to finance some of the things that we want to do. And if you think about the relationship with, between that financial anxiety and distress and just stress in general, being kept up at night, we know the relationship between financial distress and depression, for example, anxiety, panic attacks, all of these things are interlinked. And so from my perspective, I was like, you know, I don't want to have a conversation with women in which I'm isolating finance or I'm isolating investing as something that they should do, at the expense of other aspects of their well-being. And so it's very much part of the whole conversation. So when we talk about does money buy happiness, this is a conversation and a debate that I particularly love because it's interesting to see the diversity in opinion. And sometimes it can be really polarizing, as you would expect. I mean, if you ask yourself this question now, does money buy happiness? What answer would you give? Please feel free to DM me, actually, or drop a comment and let me know. Does money buy happiness? And what does it mean for you? Because from my perspective, absolutely not. I would never say that money buys happiness. But does it buy options? Yes. Does it buy help? Yes. Does it buy peace of mind? Also, yes. When I look at my own life and I think about those points in my life when I perhaps, you know, maybe going on maternity leave, for example, and suddenly going from a significantly high salary to suddenly having, you know, much reduced maternity pay and then having a portion of my maternity leave unpaid, my first maternity leave, I hadn't financially planned for it as well as I should have done, particularly somebody with my background and expertise. Why? Because of a level of complacency, a level of insouciance and kind of, you know, free-spiritedness where, you know, I'm such an eternal optimist and somebody that always believes things will be okay in the end. And I think what that led to was a situation in which I was like, oh, it'll be fine. You know, I haven't properly figured it out, but it's fine. You know, will my pension contributions still continue to be made? Not sure, but it's fine because when I get back to work, I'm going to plug those gaps. And as a result, what it meant was there was a point in my maternity leave, perhaps 9 months in, where I was like, oh, it's looking a bit tight then. You know, maybe some of these things that I want to do, perhaps I should stop, you know, dragging this tiny baby up and down to all of these museums and doing all of these lovely activities and going for all of these extravagant lunches with some of the other moms I knew. Because as much as I loved that, I was like, the finances aren't looking like they can match your aspirations to have. So you need to now rethink what you can do. So absolutely, you know, when I think about the options that money afforded me in that situation, yes, money facilitated that. And in facilitating those options, it facilitated a level of happiness that I wouldn't have otherwise had. And so this is how I rationalize, you know, when we think about does money buy happiness, I would never say, yeah, I'm just going to sit in my house with this money stacking up, you know, counting my pounds over and over and be happy with that. But if money is giving me the ability to have certain experiences, to live a certain lifestyle, to have this level of comfort that, again, we'll come back to, that, you know, for lots of us remains undefined, you know, what does comfort look like? But to certainly have the lifestyle that I wanted to have, money was a big contributory factor in that. But when we think about some of the things that are against us, you know, there's the gender pay gap that, you know, really needs no introduction. Lots of us will be familiar with this already. And the gender pay gap is compounded by this motherhood penalty that I've alluded to earlier, which is basically the point at which, you know, when we go off to have our precious babies, it leaves a gap, of course, from a maternity pay perspective. I know that there are lots of us who are fortunate enough to be on very generous maternity packages, and that's brilliant news. But for those of us that decide, even after having the child, okay, perhaps I'd like to take an extended career break. Perhaps I'd like to stay at home with my child until that child starts school at 5 or older, depending on where you live in the world. And what we see is that the data and all of the trends show that that leaves a massive gap in our lifetime earnings. So as you can see, in terms of the extent to which women are able to have the same agency in their lives from a financial perspective and the same options that men might have from a financial perspective, they are significantly squeezed as a result of that. The gender pensions gap, which is something that I've talked about quite a lot, you know, there was data and a study done by the Chartered Institute of Insurance that highlighted that the average UK woman retires at 65 with a pension pot one-fifth of the size of the average UK man's pension pot. And we're talking in real terms somewhere in the region of £35,000. If you consider that the average baby girl born today will live to 100, if you retire at 65 and you've got 35 years to live on £35,000, that's not going to go very far at all. And so it's really important that we think about some of the ways that we can plug that gap. The gender investing gap, you know, again, I've kind of touched on this very briefly, but this idea that as women, all of the data point to the fact that women are very diligent savers. And in the UK, at least, the proportion of people on a gender split basis who open up ISAs is disproportionately in favour of women. But when you look at the difference between those people opening up cash ISAs versus stocks and shares ISAs, and for the purpose of people listening that might be outside the UK or are maybe unfamiliar with ISAs, an ISA is effectively just a tax-efficient wrapper that sits around the money that you were trying to put aside for later life. And you can either have it saved in cash, in a cash-saving ISA, or you can invest it in the stock market also within this ISA. And it effectively just provides a ring fence against paying tax up to a certain level. And what we see is that women are disproportionately more likely to save via their cash ISA. And the outcome of that over the long term is financially catastrophic. I mean, effectively, you know, when you look over an 18-year period, stock market investing is virtually certain to outperform cash saving. There are a number of reasons for that. But ultimately, you know, of course, there are these sensationalist headlines, aren't they, that say, oh my gosh, like huge billions wiped off the stock market overnight. And they're not going to report, you know, billions have now been restored to the stock market. Now it's readjusted itself and the markets have stabilized and recovered. That is not newsworthy. Those things are not going to garner those massive headlines. And so it's really important, you know, from my perspective, that through Raincheck, I'm able to help women to understand how they can use investing effectively within their own lives and to understand more effectively the relationship between risk and reward, because ultimately it's risk that lots of us are running from. And so what happens is we step into this phenomenon known as reckless caution. And if you think, you know, as women, we're taking calculated risks. We think, okay, well, I'm saving for my future. I'm saving for these specific objectives, or I'm saving on behalf of children. And so on that basis, I'm going to put it in cash, because cash has to be the safest thing. If the stock market were to implode, then my cash, my nest egg, will still be intact. But of course, because of the eroding effects of inflation, the purchasing power parity that you have for that cash, if you were to put £100 in a cash savings account today, the value of that money in 10 years' time is significantly less because of the effects of inflation. Whereas if you'd put it into a stock market investment, what you'd be looking at is arguably a greater level of return. And so it's really important that we're able to educate ourselves, arm ourselves with all of the information so that we avoid this reckless caution. The reason it's referred to as that is that, you know, you think that you're doing the right thing in being cautious and taking those calculated risks, putting your money into a cash savings account. But the recklessness creeps in as a result of the fact that if you're putting all of your money, putting all of your eggs in one basket, it's completely undiversified. That's the other challenge. Completely undiversified. So you've got all of your money saved in cash. It's reckless in the sense that, you know, you're effectively eroding the value of that cash over time. So what we want to do is make sure that we are working as hard, or our money is working as hard for us as we have to work to generate it in the first place. But then what stories do we tell ourselves as rainmakers? And I think, you know, this is one of the things that I'm always most interested in whenever I, you know, have sessions in the Rainmakers Academy with the many rainmakers that I come into contact with in my personal life. I'm always really intrigued by the stories we tell ourselves, because again, this is not something that applies uniquely to women, but this is certainly something, as somebody that has a vested interest in women, and who, as I say, I'm surrounded by so many amazingly talented, well-educated women that have achieved fantastic things. To get those women to self-advocate, to get those women to speak up about their accomplishments, is a real challenge in lots of cases. And so, you know, there is something about, you know, the different ways that we self-deprecate, we self-censor, and we self-sabotage. But even more importantly than that, it's this, you know, who do we think is to blame for some of the financial pitfalls that we find ourselves within? And I'm a big believer in the idea of, you know, accepting personal responsibility for our lives. So as much as I talk about some of the challenges that exist from an institutional perspective, you know, when it comes to financial exclusion and some of the barriers that have been put up by the finance industry itself that, you know, effectively exclude not just women, but other marginalized groups from the conversation. So, of course, those things exist. And I wouldn't by any means attempt to undermine quite how challenging it is and how intimidating it can be for those people that have been excluded, particularly women. But the thing that I always stress to anybody, and it's one of the life mantras that I live by, I always focus upon what is within my gift to control. What are the various areas of my life that I am empowered to control? So as much as there's all sorts that might be swirling around outside of what I am able to control, if there's nothing I can do about it, then all I can focus on is what I am able to do about my situation, whatever that situation is. And so one of the things that has become acutely obvious to me through these conversations, and this, you know, these things apply to me as much as anybody, is that there are a number of ways, as I say, that we hold ourselves back and how it harms us financially. So, for example, it might mean not applying for that great new opportunity that we see advertised, which we know is brilliant. It ticks all the boxes in terms of our areas of interest, our expertise. And we don't apply because we say, we look at the job spec and we go, well, I can do that one. I can't do that. I can do this. I can perhaps do 2/3, 70%, 75% of this job spec. And you know that as women, if we're saying that we can do 2/3 of the job spec, it probably means that in reality, we could perhaps do 80 to 90%. You know that we self-censor all the time. We undermine ourselves in that way. And we have these crazy conversations with ourselves. Does anybody remember Ally McBeal? It's a bit like having those Ally McBeal style hallucinations in which we step into a parallel universe and we undermine ourselves in a variety of different ways. Ally McBeal was a fantastic attorney, but, you know, on the face of it, you'd think that this is, you know, a really scatty, kind of crazy, hallucinating woman. It's a similar thing that we can do in our personal lives. So, for example, if we're not applying for that great new opportunity because we're waiting to fulfill every single criteria on the job spec before we apply, and meanwhile, our male counterparts are like, I can do 25%, 30% of the things on that job spec. I'm going to go in there and blag it because guess what? If they offer me the job, then brilliant, then I'm winning. If they don't offer me the job, then what have I lost? Because they don't have that same sense of guilt or shame or, oh no, did I waste their time by applying? Oh no, I'm so embarrassed I didn't get the job. Why did I think that I could have applied for it in the first place? So it's really important that we put ourselves forward, that we're throwing our hat into the ring over and over and over again, and that we are not afraid to fail, but that we always try. So that's one of the first things that we do that can harm us financially. The second thing, of course, is, you know, thinking that, you know, we talked about this reckless caution. So we're not investing in the stock market because we prefer the safe haven of cash. You know, I've outlined why that's a problem. It might be deciding or taking a decision that we can't afford to invest in ourselves in a multitude of different ways. It's not just, you know, investing from a financial perspective. It might be, you know, well, I can't afford to do that course right now or invest in my professional development or get a gym membership. I don't have the time. You know, I'm really struggling emotionally. Perhaps, you know, there's been a big life event. I'm really struggling. But maybe I don't, you know, people like me don't get therapy. And these are conversations that I have found myself having with myself and then realizing, hang on a second, Dav, who are you to say to yourself that you can't do these things? So it's almost like stepping out of yourself and treating yourself as you would do if you were trying to coach your best friend. If your best friend were to come to you and say, I'm really struggling, you know, with my weight or my diet or my mental well-being, or I really want to get to that next stage in my career, or I want to change careers. There's no way you would say, yeah, you know, to be honest, it's over for you now. I don't even know why you bother trying. Why don't you just carry on doing what you're doing? Continue to eat those Cadbury's fingers because they'll make you feel better, like in the instant that you're eating them. They won't make you feel that good afterwards. But, you know, such is life. Sometimes we've just got to accept our lot. You would never say that to your bestie. You would hype them up. You would big them up. You would be the ultimate hype queen. And that is what I want us to do for ourselves. I want us to cheerlead ourselves in the same way we would cheerlead our very best friends, our mothers, our sisters. We would never allow them to talk badly of themselves. you would enable them to see themselves clearly. You would hold up that mirror and highlight for them everything that is great about themselves. That is what I want you to be able to do for yourself too. Another story that we might tell ourselves, or another one of the ways that we might hold ourselves back and which might ultimately end up harming us financially over the long term, is, you know, and this is again, you know, a very topical debate, you know, but thinking about maternity benefits, is it appropriate to ask about maternity benefits when you're negotiating a new job? Now, I'm not talking about, you know, in the first interview saying, yeah, what's the maternity leave? That's not a good look at all. It's the same way, you know, nobody would ever encourage you to say, what does this job pay? In the very first interview. They haven't even decided whether they like you yet, and you haven't decided whether you like them and want the job. That's another thing. You know, when we're going into interviews, we are appraising and interviewing them as much as they're appraising and interviewing us, and we should never forget that. You know, the balance of power is very evenly split, and we should go into every room with that level of confidence that you are bringing something to the table and that it is a trade. So you are trading your time and expertise in exchange for appropriate remuneration and benefit. And for lots of us, that might mean maternity benefit. So, you know, the thing that I always say is that if you get to the point of having received an offer, which is brilliant news, and you start negotiating, you're not just negotiating for your salary. There are other benefits that lots of us might have in the back of our mind that we censor ourselves again from saying because we think it speaks to a lack of commitment. And from my perspective, any company that frowns upon reproduction is a red flag, massive red flag. So, you need to think through all of these things. Some of the ways, insidious and overt, that can be harming you financially over the long term, and think about some of the ways that you can mitigate that. And hopefully, you know, through the course of this podcast series, as we get to know one another even better, we have more conversations like this, you will be able to take at least one new action after each episode. You'll feel sufficiently inspired, you'll feel uplifted and ready to seize the day and seize whatever situation you find yourself within, see the joy in it, and ultimately enrich yourself however you feel that you need to be enriched. And of course, recognizing that our wealth building journeys will all look slightly different. This is, again, you know, one of the real luxuries and privileges that I have of speaking to so many diverse women about you know, what their paths are, what it is that they're trying to pursue. And so I'm really on a mission to help all of the women I work with get specific about what their journey looks like, you know, and build a plan to achieving those goals and work the plan, you know, really work the plan. So this is not about paying lip service to, oh, you know, I really want to do this or I really want to do that. And, you know, of course, between us, we can figure out what the financial plan looks like to achieve that. But then you've got to work the plan. We're not just going to make the plan for you to sit and look at it and kind of dust it off and keep updating it, you know, week after week, month after month. But the other thing, and I guess even more importantly than that, it's about helping women to do this unapologetically. You know, I'd like you to own the things you really want to do. It doesn't mean you've got to scream it from the rooftops if you don't want to, but even just admitting to yourself what you really want to do is a massive step. One of the personal finance gurus that I particularly love is a guy called Ramit Sethi. You know, the Rainmakers will have heard me talk about him before. I've recommended his book before. And one of the things that he's a big advocate of is being clear in your own mind about what your rich life looks like. And your rich life may not necessarily mean having the mansion and the Lexus and, you know, a house full of staff. It might mean that for you, but for some people, it might look completely different. So one of the things that he always highlights in his own personal rich life is that he has taken the decision to, at least at this stage in his life, to continue to rent and not buy property, despite having many times over the wealth to be able to buy property. Why? Because it's important to him to have flexibility, him and his wife, to have the flexibility to move, to have different experiences, and to be able to travel with his work. And he doesn't want the burden of responsibility that comes from home ownership at this stage. And of course, that may change. And so giving ourselves permission to change is another part of giving ourselves that kind of agency and advocacy in our lives. You will hear me use those words over and over because it's important that we really recognize their power in helping us to live our lives unapologetically. So for me, for example, my rich life might look like, you know, I am somebody that was always a big city girl. And very recently, I relocated to an island in the Caribbean. Why? Because at this stage in my life, I wanted to live in a certain environment that soothed me. I wanted to live by the sea. There are certain projects that I'm working on that I'm really excited about. And I wanted to be in an environment that just ultimately gave me peace. And I knew that this particular environment on this particular island would facilitate me in doing that. So building a business and building a life which facilitated me in taking those steps was really important. For me, it also looks like I don't want to work Fridays, or, you know, I don't want to work Mondays sometimes. It also means I always want to do the school drop-off and the school pick-up. And when I had my corporate career, I wasn't able to do that. I was working sometimes 12 or 13 hours a day. I would have to drop my daughters at nursery at 7:30. Somebody else would have to pick them up. Sometimes I'd get home and they would just, you know, they'd be getting out of the bath already. And so all I was able to do was read them a story and give them a kiss. I want to be able to pick them up from school, hear the goss about what's happened in the playground at school, drop them to school and get them ready for the day ahead, to ask them what they're grateful for, to really hype them up, to play the music that we like, to laugh and to smile so that they go to school feeling in the right frame of mind to learn. That's all I want them to do. They are 4 and 7. Their only responsibility right now is to learn, and I take it as my personal responsibility to get them in the right frame of mind to do that. For me, my rich life also looks like I want to be able to go to luxury spas. And I'm not currently at the stage at which I'm able to go to those luxury spas with the frequency that I would most desire, but I still want to be able to go to luxury spas at least 3 or 4 times a year. So that's important to me. The other thing that, you know, again, I'd like to talk about and explore through this podcast is, you know, how I define motherhood. So my rich life looks like, you know, defining motherhood for myself and not being a martyr. So that means recognizing that I work best when I get a break. I love my daughters to bits. You know, they're with me all the time. I refer to them as my handbags, and that's brilliant. But I recognize that there are points when I need a break, and it's important that I'm able to give myself permission to ask for help. And, you know, there are lots of us, again, you know, one of the ways that we might inhibit ourselves and one of the ways that we tell ourselves, or what, you know, perhaps I shouldn't do that, or that's not what I had growing up, is thinking that the things that we desire are somehow less valuable than the thing that someone else might desire. If it's important to you, if it will improve your quality of life, spark joy in your life, and enable you to be your best self in whichever realm of life you occupy, whether it's motherhood, your business life, your corporate career, anything at all, then it's important that you give yourself permission to do that. And that's what being a wealthy woman looks like for me. So hopefully by now you'll have an idea of what you can expect from this podcast. So there will be no self-censorship. We're going to have really candid conversations with real women. And I hope that there'll be some of you that will be joining me on the podcast, you know, over the course of the next year. I'm really looking forward to having this conversation with you. Thank you for listening this far. So before we wrap up, one of the things that I'll be doing with each episode is asking my guests 3 quick fire questions so we can get to know them a little better. So I'm going to share mine with you now. I'm going to pick 3 at random. So the first question: money is no object. What are you blowing the budget on? For me, with no question, it's skincare products. I am a massive skincare junkie. Very recently, a good friend of mine encouraged me to go on this kind of 3 skincare products only regime. I'm somebody that's into it all. I want the cleanser, the toner, the double cleanser, the serum, the retinols, you know, the acid. I want it all. So my skincare regime was easily kind of 10 products strong. I say that completely unapologetically. As I say, I love skincare products. I'm fortunate enough to come from, you know, an amazing set of DNA and genetics in which, you know, when I look at, you know, my 2 grandmothers and my mother, my sister, you know, the women in my life, we all have really glowy, radiant complexions. So my skincare addiction is just because I love it. And, you know, I have to say, you know, my sad little face when I had to go on this kind of 3 product only regime as a challenge to myself. I mean, it was a bit like, you know, if you imagine like in the 80s, if you're a child of the 80s, can you imagine like Barbie and Ken's dream house being taken away from you with Skipper as well? This really is for 80s babies. Gosh, I'm absolutely showing like my era. But can you imagine like Barbie's dream house being taken away from you after you received it at Christmas? That was basically how I felt. So if money is no object, I'm blowing the budget on the top of the range skincare. Next question, complete the sentence. A rainmaker is someone who, from my perspective, a rainmaker is someone who believes in and cheers for herself, cheers for others, has the courage of her convictions, and makes things happen no matter what. So I would encourage you all to ask yourselves, what does a rainmaker look like for you? And then the final question, the book, podcast, or discovery that changed my life is, and for me, it's a book called The 4 Agreements. I love it for its clarity. I love it for its simplicity, but there are so many mic drop moments within it. And I have to say it's been completely transformative in my life. So I hope that that gives you a bit of a flavour about who I am. Who is Dav, if you've been wondering? As I say, I look forward to continuing this conversation with you. If you have any questions, then please feel free to DM us across any of our social media channels. We really look forward to hearing from you, and have a great day. Hi everyone, Davinia here. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. If any of what you heard resonated and you'd like to find out more about how Raincheck is helping women all over the world build sustainable long-term wealth, then visit our website at raincheck.com and join the mailing list for more commentary, tips and opinion on how you can start taking steps to leveling up your financial well-being today. You can follow us on social media at Raincheck, and don't forget to share, like, rate, review and subscribe. See you next time.